Trump's 9/11, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. From his Manhattan office, real estate mogul Donald Trump watched as the 9/11 attacks unfolded. 16 years later, President Trump hasn't forgotten what he saw.
I think Trump has tapped into and reflects that fear and anger many Americans felt immediately after 9/11.
Plus, how the bin Laden family turned al-Qaeda into a franchise in the years following the attacks.
Al-Qaeda Central ruled over them in a McDonald kind of a way, where McDonald owns the brand, but they don't own the branches. They don't own the affiliates.
And we remember Nancy Dupree's love affair with Afghanistan.
From the beginning, she developed an instantaneous connection with the place.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you here with us this Monday. Think about it. We're getting to the point that almost a generation has passed since 9/11, and it's no longer something everyone remembers. It's got to be taught.
Today, so far, we haven't learned about 9/11. We usually learn about it in history class. We briefly go over what the event is.
That's the younger sister of my colleague, Amulya Shankar. Amulya was in third grade on 9/11, her sister not yet born. We'll speak with both of them later on the show, a new generation wrestling with the evolving meaning of the attack and its consequences. We begin our coverage with the world's Matthew Bell, who has been digging into what 9/11 means and has meant to President Trump and his worldview.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, real estate developer and native New Yorker Donald J. Trump was at the office.
Well, I have a window that looks directly at the World Trade Center.
That's Trump on the phone with a local TV news show on the day the towers came down.
I saw this huge explosion. I was with a group of people, and I really couldn't even believe it. And even, I think, worse than that, for years I've looked right directly at the building. I'd see the Empire State Building in the foreground and the World Trade Center in the background, and now I'm looking at absolutely nothing. It's just gone. And it's just hard to believe.
Trump went on to mention that his building at 40 Wall Street had suddenly gone from being the second tallest building in downtown Manhattan to the tallest. One of the people in the TV studio talking with the future president was Alan Marcus, a friend and former PR guy for Trump. At one point, Marcus asked Trump to imagine himself in the White House.
In the year 2000, Donald, you considered running for president. If you had done that and if you had been successful, what do you think you'd be doing right now?
Well, I'd be taking a very, very tough line, Alan. I mean, most people feel they know at least approximately the group of people that did this and where they are. But boy, would you have to take a hard line on this. This just can't be tolerated.
Fast forward 16 years, al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden is dead, but the war in Afghanistan, al-Qaeda's former stronghold, is still not over. And of course, it's President Donald J. Trump who's commander-in-chief now.
9/11, the worst terrorist attack in our history, was planned and directed from Afghanistan because that country was ruled by a government that gave comfort and shelter to terrorists.
That's President Trump speaking to U.S. military personnel last month, explaining his plans to send more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. It's one of many instances with Trump's emerging foreign policy where you can hear the reverberations of the September 11th attacks.
I think Trump has tapped into and reflects that fear and anger many Americans felt immediately after 9/11.
Brian Katulis is a national security expert at the liberal-leaning Center for American Progress.
It's this America First slogan that he has, this notion of a gated community concept of security, that we got to throw up barriers to entry to this country, build walls.
When the 2016 campaign got rolling, Trump attacked Barack Obama's Middle East policy as a disaster, but he also attacked George W. Bush for invading Iraq and nation building.
What he tapped into was this broader American societal sense that we had expended a lot of resources in these places and tried to actually remake them in our own image, and that the George W. Bush freedom agenda to try to expand democracy and freedom to defeat terrorism had utterly failed. The thing that's really curious about Trump, which makes him an anomaly for presidents, is that he's really stepped away from any sense of a moral values component of trying to defeat this threat.
As far as Syria is concerned, we have very little to do with Syria other than killing ISIS. What we do is we kill ISIS.
That's Trump speaking just last week. If there's a motto for the new president's foreign policy, it would be something like doing more with less, according to Mike Doran. He's a security expert at the conservative Hudson Institute. Doran says Trump's foreign policy approach is shaping up to look a little like Richard Nixon's.
That's what I think it is. I mean, Nixon, the country, and after the Vietnam War, very skeptical about the use of the military abroad. And Nixon realized that, and so he started relying more on allies and building them up as sort of policemen who would look after American interests.
Doran says Trump got off to a promising start with his first presidential trip to the Middle East, which included a headline-grabbing photo op in Saudi Arabia.
The sword dance in Saudi Arabia and the trip to Israel that he also made at the time indicated that Trump was going to rely much more on allies than President Obama had. And those allies are primarily concerned with the rise of Iran.
Doran says an enduring mistake with American foreign policy since September 11th has been to focus too much on Sunni extremist groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS. President Trump appears to be more willing to confront what Mike Doran calls the Shiite extremist state of Iran.
It's our job to organize the region. I think President Obama's policy taught us that the problems of the Middle East don't stay in the Middle East. So if we leave the Middle East, those problems are going to follow us. Look at all of the refugees from Syria and look at the tensions that they caused in Europe.
If President Trump does hope to organize the region, it's far from clear just how he plans to do so. One thing that both experts I spoke with told me is that this president has not fully thought through where he wants to go with his foreign policy. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
No matter where Trump does decide to go with his foreign policy, he would do well not to underestimate the staying power of al-Qaeda. It still has offshoots in many places around the world. Former FBI agent Ali Soufan has followed al-Qaeda for years. His latest book, Anatomy of Terror, came out earlier this year. So what is your assessment of the threat from al-Qaeda to Americans today, Ali Soufan? This is 16 years after 9/11. I mean, if the White House asks you for a bullet point brief on the state of al-Qaeda, what would you say?
I think we need to basically put al-Qaeda in the context of the global jihadi movement. So a lot of time we talk about ISIS, but we forget that ISIS was a branch of al-Qaeda. It was a rogue organization. ISIS, until today, believes that they are the true followers of Osama bin Laden. They are bin Laden's al-Qaeda, not Zawahiri's al-Qaeda, as one ISIS commander said. So we have to put it in that context, and we have to look into the ideology of bin Ladenism, if you want to call it, the narrative of Osama bin Laden, which include ISIS and al-Qaeda and all the different Qaeda affiliates. We need to focus on that narrative, and we need to defeat the narrative, not to get blinded by names, AQAP or AQAM or ISIS or, you know, al-Qaeda Central. We are facing the same kind of poisonous tree, the same fruits of these poisonous tree. Number two, I think we need to start preparing for a big comeback by al-Qaeda. Today, they have different affiliates. All these affiliates are way bigger than al-Qaeda used to be 2001. And eventually, these affiliates can stop looking to operate locally and start going back to the global jihad. And we need to be ready for that. We cannot be, you know, taken back like we were at 2001. And I think a lot of these things that's happening in the Middle East, in places like Yemen or places like Syria or places like Libya or Somalia, will have a global impact down the road if we don't deal with it today.
But to what end? Like, what is the al-Qaeda mission today? Does it differ from what it was in 2001?
Well, yes, it mutated and it changed, especially after the Arab Spring. After the Arab Spring, Osama bin Laden told his commanders, I know I told you to attack only the United States, but now the Arab Spring is giving us a new opportunity. It's giving us an opportunity that did not exist since the time of Saladin, you know, from the time of the Crusades. Mm. And we need to take advantage of that chaos that exists and prevent anyone else from bringing security or stability to these areas, because that person who's going to bring stability to a place like, you know, Syria or Yemen or, you know, whatever, he's going to be the new dictator. He's going to be the new agent for the Americans. So we need to create chaos. And he actually told his commanders, I'm telling you something which means many, many Muslims have to die. And he continued in his letter by saying, we have to kill them to save them. We have to kill them to save them.
Wow.
So this is the idea of Al-Qaeda. This is how Al-Qaeda shifted after the Arab Spring. Bin Laden was very pragmatic, and he played with, you know, what life gave him, right? So he changed the organization. And that allowed all these franchises to become bigger and bigger. And Al-Qaeda Central ruled over them in a McDonald kind of a way, where McDonald owns the brand, but they don't own the branches. They don't own the affiliates. And this is where we are today. Unfortunately, 16 years later, we're still dealing with the same kind of threat.
Right, so many affiliates, but who's running it to kind of bring a cohesive, singular vision to the organization? Does that exist?
Yeah, Al-Qaeda Central still plays a big role in coordinating these affiliates and providing an overall strategy. However, Osama bin Laden, before his death, gave the affiliates the freedom to manage their own organizations locally. So they start focusing on local factors that they can take advantage of for the sake of the organization. Today, you know, Ayman Zawahiri, current leader of Al-Qaeda, is not that charismatic figure that can unify these organizations under the brand of bin Laden, like bin Laden did before. However, I believe that Al-Qaeda is planning to create a new leader or to nominate a new leader who might be able to unify all these affiliates under the same banner. And it is bin Laden's beloved son, Hamza. And it seems that in the last few years, Al-Qaeda have been doing just that, trying to promote Hamza to be possibly the unifier of the global jihadi movement.
Considering bin Laden had like anywhere between 20 and 26 children, why does Hamza stand out?
Well, he is the one who is willing to do that. He is the one who is really a true believer in his dad's message. Many of the other sons left. They are not there. He is the son of the favorite wife who was also as radical as Osama bin Laden, and she pushed her son on the path of Al-Qaeda and in the path of this global jihad movement. And third, he is the guy who most of the top leaders of Al-Qaeda who were with him in jail educated him and prepared him to that role. So he has the support of the senior leaders of the organization. He was pushed into that position with his mother. And frankly, among all his sons, he is the only one who's willing to do it.
You know, it was really interesting to hear presidential candidates last year assess the biggest threats in the world, in their opinion. Some candidates mentioned Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and terror. Russia and nukes were also cited. Bernie Sanders cited climate change. I know the terrorist threat is what you focus your time on, Ali Soufan. It is a real threat. But when you look at all the threats in the world, is it the most existential, do you think?
I think, my God, the biggest threat I think we have is the threat against our democracy. And I think the threat against the current world order that exists, that's going to be very destabilizing. And what we've seen today with allies basically not trusting the United States, not trusting the gold standard that the United States brought to international order and national stability, I think that is a big, big threat for our own national security interest. If you want to talk about the globe, you know, globally, what is the biggest threat? Definitely, I have to go with global warming. How can't you go with global warming when you see what we've seen today in Miami and in Texas and elsewhere? But I think when it comes to the United States, I believe it is a threat that we face, you know, against our democracy, against our values, against our principles, against our way of life that have significant impact on our allies in Europe and around the world.
Ali Soufan, former FBI agent and author of Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the woman known as Afghanistan's grandmother. This is The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Nancy Hatch Dupree died in Kabul this weekend at the age of 89. She's remembered as the founder of the Afghanistan Center at Kabul University, but she wouldn't necessarily want it that way.
This is not an achievement of any one individual. People seem to always zero in and say, my collection, or Nancy Dupree's collection, Nancy Dupree's new building, not mine.
She wanted people in Afghanistan to feel like the collection belonged to them. The center is the country's first dedicated to the study of its own history, and it happens to hold thousands of documents collected by Dupree herself. Mujib Mashal, the New York Times senior correspondent in Afghanistan, was there just this Sunday. What was it like to be at the center at Kabul University the day that Dupree died?
Well, it was a little odd because I went in thinking there would be grief and there would be, you know, mourning all over. But it almost felt like the way it was operating is how she would have wanted it. The business was going on as usual. I think by noon, I looked at the registry and about 85 researchers and students of the university had sort of registered their names and gone in to look for a book or a document or use the internet services at the center. Just the only difference was there was a bit of media presence in the corner, and then her office was empty. There's a picture of her on her desk. There's a bouquet of flowers on her chair. And then her books, her five books that she wrote, were sitting on display. So it was clear that people were celebrating and mourning her in one corner, but the work of the center was going on as normal on the other hand.
Yeah, it sounds like that's probably what she would have wanted. How did this woman, Nancy Dupree, born in New York, how'd she become known as the grandmother of Afghanistan?
She always talked about how it was actually her first love, this man named Louis Dupree, who kind of created this connection for her with Afghanistan. In 1962, she arrives in Kabul as the wife of an American diplomat, who actually in some magazine profiles say he wasn't a diplomat. He was a CIA station chief in Afghanistan. But in the social scene of Kabul, 1960s, she meets this archaeologist who was also married, and they develop an affair. They divorce their spouses. They get married, and their spouses end up marrying each other.
Wow.
Which is
it's kind
quite
of scandalous
a,
for 1960 Kabul.
Absolutely. And one of the versions of the story goes that the scandal was so much that the American embassy told Nancy and Louis Dupree to finally make this marriage official, and they get married. So her connection to Afghanistan, her love affair with this archaeologist and their travels together around Afghanistan is how this deep connection to the place begins in the 1960s.
I mean, it could have gone in all sorts of directions, but it did go in this direction of Nancy Dupree committing herself to preserving Afghanistan's history and culture. Where did that come from?
It almost feels like from the beginning, she developed an instantaneous connection with the place, because in the 1970s, the communist government suspected her and her husband of being American spies, and they kicked him out of the country. And they could have gone on to anywhere else, but they decided to move to Peshawar, which is just across the border in Pakistan. And it was the hub of the Afghan guerrillas preparing and training and arming to come back into Afghanistan and topple the communist regime. They decided to go there. They almost sort of followed the wave of Afghans. Wherever they went with them. It almost as if that became the mission of her life very quickly, that she would work with this place, even if she was kicked out. There were some really difficult years for that work. 1990s in particular, during the Taliban government.
Yeah, how did she operate during that time, kind of trying to deal with this history?
It wasn't just the history because of their travels around the country. They had seen the country's art. They had seen the country's culture. And in 1990s, the Taliban government was basically anti-art. And they started smashing some of the statues at the Kabul Museum. And people who worked at the museum would tell you stories of Nancy making trips from Peshawar to Kabul to meet with senior Taliban officials and try to convince them to preserve these artifacts. And the amazing part was that the Taliban Minister of Culture reciprocated her visits, that he would go back to Peshawar and meet with her, which is quite an amazing thing
considering
how that government viewed women.
You know, when Trump increased U.S. troop levels for Afghanistan recently, it was reported by the Washington Post that National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster had shown the president a photo from 1972 of Afghan women in miniskirts in Kabul, apparently to show that Afghanistan had once adopted Western values and could do it again if the war went the right way. What do you think Nancy Dupree would have said about that analysis?
I think she would have seen the irony of it. The irony being that, yes, that was the reality of Afghanistan for a period. But the fact that that was destroyed partially happened because of U.S. funneling a lot of money to anti-Soviet guerrillas who were highly extremist, who sort of reversed a lot of decades of gains that had brought Afghanistan to that 1950s and 1960s. So she would have seen through that it's not so simple. The U.S. has also been a factor in Afghanistan, turning to what it is today. But as part of her mission was to introduce that Afghanistan of the 1950s and 1960s, not only to the world, to the outside world, but also to generations of Afghans themselves, like me, who are younger, who did not see or experience that time. That was part of her, you know, final mission, is to try to introduce as much of what she saw in those years, both inside Afghanistan, but also projected to the outside.
Well, it's a perfect segue to my last question, Mujib, which is, where were you on 9/11, and what thoughts occur to you with the death of Nancy Dupree coming as it does on the eve of 9/11, which drew Afghanistan immediately into George W. Bush's global war on terror?
I was either in Kabul or I was north of Kabul, because 2 days before 9/11, Ahmad Shah Massoud was killed.
Right.
He was the leader of the anti-Taliban resistance. I was a child back then, but my parents and family could sense that something was about to happen. So knowing that Nancy's death has happened around that anniversary, in a lot of ways, there is this appreciation for this individual whose commitment to Afghanistan preceded the 1970s and 1980s American interest, which was directly focused in countering the Soviet influence, and the recent wave of U.S. interest, which is against al-Qaeda and terrorists, that she represents in a way a long-term understanding and commitment to this place. And the opposite of that, which has been sort of sporadic, reactionary involvement in this place, has meant this history, this modern history of, you know, ups and downs.
Mujib Mishal, thanks very much for your thoughts today on this sad moment that we're marking, the death of Nancy Dupree. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
That's Mujib Mishal, the New York Times senior correspondent in Afghanistan.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple, jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Amulya Shankar was a third grader on the day of the 9/11 attacks.
I remember a very distinct before and after in terms of how school was different and how sometimes people would treat me differently.
How a new generation remembers and is taught what happened 16 years ago. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. With the 2016 election behind us, many people are worried about the midterm elections in 2018, worried about more fake news manipulation, and also worried about actual hacking of election machines. So what would be the drawback of dumping the machines and going with secure paper ballots? Well, let's take a look at Norway. They go to the polls today, a tight electoral race to choose the new government, and Norwegians actually still use paper ballots, which are counted by machine. And in fact, this time the Norwegian government is insisting on hand counting the ballots as well. That is new. Terje Solsvik is Reuters Oslo reporter. So why are the machines not being trusted this election?
Questions have been raised over the trustworthiness of computers for reasons that could range from hacking, of course, to the basic security and design of systems. And while there's nobody saying that, you know, we're being hacked, a trust issue with regards to making sure that the electorate feels comfortable about what's going on. So we're actually taking a big step back in time, back to what it was like in the 80s when everything was, and before that, of course, when everything was counted by hand. It's also a way to ensure that the electorate is confident that that the results of this election is going to be correct.
And where did the impulse to do this hand counting of handwritten ballots, where did that come from? Was it the people of Norway who asked for it?
We saw some security experts who raised concerns a few weeks ago. They were asking questions. It was a story that got picked up by local media, and it kind of snowballed from there, where the government realized that it had an issue on its hands that it needed to deal with, a confidence issue, if you like. So instead of going out and reassuring people and saying that, yeah, the machines are fine, they came out and said, okay, fine, we'll count everything by machine, but we'll also count everything by hand. So everything will, in fact, get counted twice. There'll be scanners, yes, but there's also a hand count of all the votes.
Has there ever been any kind of funny business with Norway's elections?
Not really. I mean, when you're counting, I don't know, 3.8 million votes as we're counting here today, there will always be somebody who shows up at the ballot and is confused and doesn't feel that they've been able to, I don't know, maybe they didn't find the ballot they were looking for. Maybe they didn't know the procedures. But no one's ever questioned the integrity of the election in that regard.
So I have to wonder how much of this confidence issue with the vote in Norway is really about Norway looking to what the U.S. went through in our last presidential election, not to mention France in their election this year.
Yeah. The government ominously refers to increasing activity and attention domestically and internationally regarding the technical solutions that are being used. And our security services have been involved in this, both the police and the national security authority here have been evaluating this. And clearly, in the coming years, there's going to be a lot of attention paid to how these systems are organized.
I know you said there's no evidence of hacking. I'm just wondering, you know, we hear the Russian government did not really relish the idea of a Hillary Clinton presidency. Is there any specific issue in Norway that some foreign government or governments might want to force through a hack?
If there was, we haven't heard. There hasn't been election rumors. The debate here, if you like, is about the usual stuff. It's about public services. It's about taxes and how much they should go up or down. It's the usual meat and potatoes type of election. But, of course, Norway is involved in a lot of things. Norway's involved in NATO operations. Norway is involved mm-hmm. in the various embargoes on Russian trade after the Ukraine crisis and so on. So there's lots of things that potentially could be of interest to people beyond our borders, but we have no indication that anyone is actually involved or interested in influencing the election in that regard.
Terje Salzvik, Reuters also a reporter. Thank you for your time today, Terje.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
From paper ballots back to very high tech now. We've been hearing a lot of unconfirmed reports these past few months about hackers trying to break into the energy sector in the U.S. and abroad. It now appears power grid controls in the U.S. have been infiltrated. That's according to a new report by the cybersecurity firm Symantec. It found that hackers gained enough access to stop the flow of electricity to homes and businesses in the countries affected.
That's sort of the most concerning part of what we've discovered.
Eric Chin is a security analyst with Symantec.
Typically, these attackers, when they get into energy companies that are doing things like supplying power or plugged into the power grid, usually they get into what's called the administrative side of the network, or the part where maybe people are just checking their emails. There's a second side to that network, which we call the operational side, and that's the side where computers are actually controlling things on the power grid.
Has this ever happened in the U.S., that hackers got this kind of access to power control systems?
Yeah, we're unaware of them getting this level of access on this scale. We're not just talking about sort of one organization, but multiple organizations within the U.S.
Are you able to say which organizations, which utilities they gained access to?
No, normally we don't name sort of the organizations who've been compromised. What we can say is we've seen dozens of organizations compromised. And then out of those, we've seen a handful where it's clear that they're potentially on the operational side.
And what do you know so far about who is behind these attacks?
Well, we've mapped it to a group that we call Dragonfly. This group, actually, we first disclosed back in 2014 when they tried to do something similar, but not at this scale, nor, you know, they didn't get in as far into sort of the operational network, especially in the U.S. There have been other reports out there in the media that this is potentially a nation state, but based at least on the technical evidence we have at hand, we can't really say.
Now, according to your report, Dragonfly, this group of hackers, gained access to these systems months ago, but we haven't seen any mass power outages yet. Why is that? And why would a group kind of try and hack in but kind of stop short of the finish line of doing the nasty deed?
Yeah, you have to think a little bit about their motivation here. So, you know, we haven't seen anything like extortion demands. This doesn't appear to be anything like general cybercrime where they're going after money or economic corporate espionage. This definitely seems at something at the level of a nation state. And when you're talking about nation states, there's obviously political motivations at play here. And that sort of thing we haven't seen just yet.
Have you given any advice to the companies that were affected?
Yeah, we've reached out to over 100 different energy companies, both in the U.S. and in Europe. Not all of them may have been compromised. And basically, we've provided them what we call indicators of compromise to basically hunt in their network to see if they were affected. Unfortunately, remediation in this case isn't that simple. Typically, you would just simply reimage your machines, remove the malicious software, and sort of move on. But in this case, the actors were going heavily after credentials. So even after you do that, they still actually might have things like usernames and passwords and being able to get back into these systems.
Yeah, so if the hackers indeed at some point were to control a system and shut down the electricity for like 1.5 million households, what could that utility do to get back control of their power plant? Anything?
You know, we have some precedents here where hackers in the Ukraine actually got into the power grid there and shut off the electricity. You know, it's one thing to shut off the electricity. Clearly, these organizations could potentially just flip it back on. But what we saw the hackers do in the Ukraine was they conducted sort of a secondary attack after that, where they basically wiped all the machines. They wiped what's called the firmware on these switches or devices that are controlling the power grid, trying to cause sort of physical hardware effects that were much more difficult to flip back on. Back in the Ukraine, they were actually quite successful. They were able to flip the power back on within about 6 hours. Mm. So, you know, hopefully, you know, we'd be able to see something similar in the United States if such a thing happened.
So final question, Eric. These past few months, we've also been hearing about attempted attacks against nuclear facilities in the U.S. and abroad. Are these two things related? Are those attacks connected to the ones we've been hearing about today from you?
Yeah, those reports that came out in the public, unfortunately, didn't have any sort of technical indicators that allow us to map them together. However, just based on the timing, it would seem highly coincidental that they are unrelated. You know, so it seems pretty reasonable that these are likely the same actors involved.
Eric Chin, a security analyst with Symantec, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
We know the big story, young people from Central America migrating to the U.S. to escape violence or to find work. But when we're talking individual people, we don't really know all their stories. And if tragedy strikes them after they've gotten to the U.S., we often won't hear about what happens after. Take the story of a 17-year-old immigrant. Earlier this summer, he was driving to work in rural Alabama. It was his second day on the job, but he never made it. He died in a car accident on the way. From Guatemala, reporter Deepa Fernandez tells us how his family struggled to get information and bring his body home.
Jose Lopez Ramirez grew up in a little house on this winding road that leads into a mountainous Guatemalan town called Comitancillo. Ramirez lived here until last year when he moved 200 miles away to Guatemala's capital city to find work and finish school. He was 16 when he left, and he joined his older brother, Ageo Lopez Ramirez, in Guatemala City. And that's when Jose's problems started, his brother says.
Tenía muchos sueños y...
He had so many dreams, but it was there that the gangs began to bother us, trying to get us to join. It's different in Guatemala City. There the gangs kill and rob people. So we left and just came back home.
Back in Comitancillo, a rural and mostly indigenous area, life was not much easier when the brothers returned.
Back here it was the same as when we left. There's no jobs. And that's when Jose decided to go to the U.S.
Ageo said his younger brother was excited about the possibilities in America. And while his journey overland was rough, he made it. And soon thereafter, sent his family and friends this video.
Hola amigos, ¿cómo están? Este es mi primer video, presentándome al fin. Al fin decidí abrir mi cuenta.
A handsome boy with perfectly combed jet black hair looks flirtatiously at the camera, telling his viewers he's just opened an account where he can make short videos and upload them. He's asking his viewers to tell him what they think. Back in his concrete two-room home, Jose's brother scrolls through a bunch of photos on his phone, all sent by Jose from America. He finds this video Jose shot at his construction job where he's riding a large bulldozer, kind of like he's on a bull at the rodeo.
Ojalá.
And this was the last one they received, where he's got that perfectly combed hair again and his arm is around a girl. And then abruptly the video cuts out. They never really got much information on how exactly Jose died. Just the very basics from what the police told Jose's sister, who also lives in Alabama. This is what she called and told them, according to Jose's father, Eusebio.
Pues él iba al trabajo.
He was going to work around 5 a.m. when he crashed, and that's how he died.
Being undocumented, Jose's sister was too afraid to engage the police and ask more questions, but she did learn that the crash was bad. The car flipped.
Quebró todo lo que es sus huesos.
He broke all of his bones, and his face and head were smashed too.
Su cabeza.
That was late May. The family in Guatemala was devastated. They had so many questions, but no one to ask them to. They barely have cell phone reception in their home in the mountains, and looking up information on the internet when Jose's brother Ageo could get to a connection provided nothing. Then, one afternoon in mid-June, a few weeks after Jose had died, they got another call from his sister in America. She said a local church had gathered the money to send Jose's body home. It was arriving in 6 hours in Guatemala City. They scrambled.
Thank God we had a neighbor who lent us his car. When we said we had to go and collect Jose's body, our neighbor really helped us. He even came with us to get him.
It was a bit of an ordeal for Ageo, his dad, and their neighbor. When they got there, it wasn't just Jose's body. There were two other bodies that arrived on the same plane from the United States. Ageo had to open the body bag to identify his brother. And then together, they heaved the lengthy cardboard box into the back of their neighbor's car and made the long journey home. The box with Jose's body hung precariously out of the small car the entire ride. The long, thin white cardboard box which held his body still sits in the family's main room. I ask Eusebio, Jose's father, what they plan to do with the box. He wants to keep it right there in memory of his son, he says. His laughter is not a happy laugh. This is a grieving father. Eusebio brings out a garbage bag of Jose's clothes. Eusebio is telling me that he packed up his son's clothes and things when he left for America. Now he won't be back to use them again, he tells me, as he begins putting them back in the bag. Jose also left behind much younger siblings. They're busy playing during my entire visit. But when Eusebio actually opens the bag of Jose's clothes, they stop in their tracks and come to look. Ageo asks a little one if she remembers her brother, Jose.
¿Recordas a Jose?
Yes, she says. And where is he? Ageo follows up. In the United States, she says. It's still kind of hitting them all that Jose is dead and not just working in the U.S. Ageo says they haven't had much time to mourn as they owe a lot of money.
We are now suffering the consequences of Jose following his dreams, you know, what many people call the American dream. The truth is we have to pay his debts. My dad and I were just discussing how we both have to work to pay it off. We still owe 30,000 quetzales.
That's a bit over $4,000. A fortune in these parts where one day of agriculture work, if he can find it, may yield $5. They owe the coyote who helped Jose get to Alabama. They even owe money to the American rental car company for the car Jose crashed. But, says Ageo, as they work to pay off his debts, at least they'll be remembering him constantly. For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Comitancillo, Guatemala.
Deepa's reporting was supported by the International Women's Media Foundation as part of its Adelante Latin America reporting initiative. It struck me this morning that we're not just marking the anniversary of 9/11. We're also coming close to a generation since it happened. So for many of us, the day has that you-know-where-you-were-when-it-happened quality to it. And for many others, we don't remember the day because we were either so young or not even born. Yeah, think about that. The world's Amulya Shankar was in elementary school at the time. So what is your memory of 9/11, Amulya?
I think my memory was a little different than most people my age because I happened to have a dentist appointment that morning. And my dad was driving me in a little late, and I was chattering away about something, and I distinctly remember him, like, shushing me and turning on the radio, like, leaning in. Mm. I think he pulled over at one point. So I knew something big was going on, and I remember hearing the words, like, plane crashing, and I remember looking up at the sky because I thought he was so concerned because something was near us. And we went to school, and everyone was panicked. Nothing happened that day. That night, my parents hate television, mostly, but they had it on all night, and they were watching the footage over and over, so I knew something big had happened.
Right. Well, you lived outside at the time of Philadelphia, so physically you were not that far away, were you?
Yeah, but I had no sense of it at the time. I remember my parents' reactions more than anything. I remember, like, each new piece of information, my parents' reaction, we're going to war. First Afghanistan, then Iraq, then weapons of mass destruction. I remember that phrase heard over and over and over. And by the time of the 2004 election, that was when I really had a sense of, oh, this may not end. Like, I'm going to be hearing about this for a really long time.
Right. This was a narrative that had a beginning and a middle, still not an end. Now, someone you know really well was not yet born on September 11, 2001. That'd be your sister.
Yeah. Chaitra was born 2 months after 9/11. And I know for me, there was a very distinct before and after 9/11. But for her, since she was born afterwards, she had a very different experience. 9/11 was very much a thing that she heard about from us, her family, and through textbooks in history class. I was talking to her the other day, and she said she never really knew the reasons 9/11 happened or what had happened necessarily until she was taught it in a timeline format in history class. But she always knew it was a really big deal because of the way people talked about it. She said people got sort of somber, and that day in school would be reserved for looking back and having a moment of silence. So I thought we'd talk to her, and she can put it in her own words.
All right, let's give her a call.
Hi, Chaitra.
Hi, Chaitra. This is Marco Werman here in Boston.
Hello.
So I'm glad you took a little break from your classes today just to speak with us. Do you remember when you started learning about 9/11 in school?
I learned about it in seventh grade by watching a video, like a really emotional video on it. It had people who lost their family members talking, so it made me feel very empathetic towards them.
Chaitra, can you describe what you learned? What did you learn about what actually happened that day?
I learned that it was an Islamic terrorist group called Al-Qaeda, and it was a terrorist plane that crashed into the Twin Towers. And I learned that people died that day many ways, jumping off buildings, and also the building set on fire, so it slowly burned down to the ground. We usually learn about it in history class. We briefly go over what the event is, and since seventh grade, we watched some sort of video or saw pictures of the event.
Yeah, I'm curious, how do other kids in the classroom react during these videos? Does it feel like it's something that has to happen because it's 9/11? Do people pay attention?
During those videos, I think it really grabs everyone's attention. It not only like grabs their attention, it also makes even like the people who usually don't want to pay attention, they still see it and like are shocked that such an event happened, and it grabs their attention.
I want to ask both you and Amulya something, because after 9/11, there were many incidents of racial aggression, targeting of Muslims, of people assumed to be Muslim. You're Indian Americans. Did 9/11 become personal for both of you?
I distinctly remember there being a before and after. My parents, like you said, are Indian. They have accents. the way people treated them definitely changed in the first couple years after 9/11. So seeing that was different. And for myself, there was a definite uptick in questions like, where are you from? Where are you really from? People would ask if I was Muslim, that kind of thing. So yeah, I was definitely more aware, and I felt like I had to be aware. I just had to have more knowledge in order to explain to people who I was in relation to 9/11. I don't know if you remember this, Chaitra, but I remember a conversation we had once. Somebody asked you if you were Muslim, and I remember explaining Islamophobia to you because you were confused as to why they were asking that at all, because you thought of 9/11 as something that terrorists did, not something that Muslims did. Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but yeah, it really still does confuse me.
What more would you like to know about 9/11, Chaitra, that you feel like there are blanks that you want to fill in?
The bigger picture instead of like the little details of it and the aftermath of it. I want to be able to see more points of view on the subject.
So there you have it, a younger generation born after 9/11 trying to make sense of the event growing up and now starting to see the big picture but hungry for more information. That was Chaitra Shankar taking a break from her 10th grade classes today. We also heard from the world's Amulya Shankar, Chaitra's older sister. This talk about a new generation's view of recent history made me think of this new track from a voice from the other side of the globe. You want to see us on your TV. You want to read us in the newsfeed. But the time did come. Change keeps beating like a drum. Cause the people have the power. They keep waking by the hour. And the youth them see. So they're breaking free from your mental slavery. Generation. This is Australian reggae star Natalie Rise. Her latest album came out in March. The first one she's released since decamping from Down Under to Kingston, Jamaica in 2014. Natalie Rise was already a pretty convincing performer of Jamaican music, and from the sound of it, with her move to Kingston, she sounds more like a local than ever. We leave you with more of her track, Generations Will Rise, from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.